So speaking of mice experiments, what I'd like to talk about is AKG.
Alpha-ketoglutarate.
So you were last August, there were, you were co-author on a paper, alpha-ketoglutarate and endogenous metabolite extends lifespan and compresses morbidity in aging mice. So could you introduce AKG? Why is it so important?
Okay, so AKG, I mean, anyone who remembers their first year biochemistry, even high school biochemistry, will remember the TCA cycle, which is obviously important in energy generation. And there's AKG right there in the TCA cycle. And I, you know, for many years, I think that was the principal role that people thought about, that, that this is an intermediate in central metabolism involved in energy production. And then actually now, if you do a search on AKG, you can see that it's involved in a myriad of biological processes. And that's because it's a cofactor for multiple enzymes, many, many enzymes involved in epigenetics, in cancer, in development. And so you stand back and it's a very complex picture actually for AKG. In terms of aging, the one thing we know is that AKG levels go down in human sera with age quite dramatically by about tenfold actually. And we tend not to, our approach in studying aging is not to be biased by particular mechanisms. So we didn't go in to study AKG. Maybe we're not smart enough to you know, find the things that might work. What we do is to screen for metabolized natural products, synthetic chemical compounds that move the needle for aging. And we do this in the nematode worm. It's one of the few systems you can really screen for compounds that extend lifespan. So our first question is, does this intervention extend lifespan?
And that's how we came across AKG.
Right.
And I should say that the lab that published this first was a great paper in the Hoon lab in Nature showing that AKG extended lifespan in the nematode. And they also proposed at that time that this interacted with a major known aging pathway, which is the TOR pathway. So that was a great paper. At the point that paper came out, we already had AKG on our radar because it was coming out of screens. And so this is where you're, if you don't mind, I'll just take a second to describe. You know, we've got these tiny 1 millimeter nematode worms. They're in, it wells in a microtiter plate and they're all aging synchronously. And we're adding various natural products and chemical compounds to those wells. And we're sitting at the microscope looking at these wells asking, are they alive or dead? And, you know, so when all your control worms are dead and you've got your worms swimming around in the other wells, AKG came up time and time and time again as a really interesting hit. So that was how we got there. I mean, it's there's a great literature, but we hadn't read it. We just knew that it extended lifespan in worms.
Okay, excellent. So can you talk about the experiment? And the results that you saw? I mean, this was the experiment you decided, because it worked in C. elegans, you were going to try it in mice.
Yes, and I should say that decision point is kind of interesting, because we have maybe, you know, at least 100 compounds that extend lifespan in worms. And how do you decide then to do the sort of $1 million experiment of going into mice? But that really was influenced by, you know, the publication from the other lab. It was influenced by the fact it kept coming up and up again in our lab. And yes, we made that decision with our collaborator, Brian Kennedy, who was really essentially the mouse lab at that point. We were moving into mice for the first time to have a look at this. And we kind of did it in a shoestring budget to a certain extent. But then I also had an incredible PhD student, Azar Shamirez, who's in the University of Southern California Buck PhD program, and she really drove this along with a postdoc, Daniel Edgar. But really, Azar had high faith in the data that we were seeing in worms. She'd worked in the worms. She saw this happening in the worms, and. I don't know. I mean, I think this is true of many of the people who work in worms and flies. They really do believe that the mechanisms they're studying are likely to influence aging in mammals as well. Part of that faith comes from the genetics. So we decided to take mice that were sort of late middle age and feed them a diet AKG and work out what was going on.
Interesting. So you you started with late middle age, so this would kind of imply that if you take AKG later, you may have the same effect. You may not.
Yes, and so there's two reasons for late middle age. One is that's probably where most people would be comfortable with human interventions. I think we're all a little bit uncomfortable about the idea of giving healthy teenagers aging interventions. So it's a practical reason. And the other practical reason actually is just the finances. I mean, you know, to age mice, you know, to get out to 2 years is it takes a long time, costs a lot of money. So if you can source mice that are already older, then you're off to the races. You're collecting data right away.
Right. Interesting. So, and what did you, what kind of results did you see for this?
Right. So we did a, two things. We wondered whether the AKG could actually extend lifespan. Which is, you know, it's been done in mice before by many compounds, but that was an obvious question for us. But in some ways, we were also more interested in whether there was any evidence of health span extension. In other words, were the animals, you know, is there postponed disease? Is there evidence that the animals are prolonging their youthfulness, if you want to call it that? And you know, there's a lot of interest in the field, as you've heard from many people, about the idea of health span and actually the health span being more important than lifespan. Going back to the beginning of our conversation, that there's no point in extending lifespan if we don't see incremental health increases as well, right, from any standpoint, including the economical one. So we wanted to include health span. Now, our institute, the Buck Institute, is very well set up to do complex functional measures of mouse aging, and we really couldn't do this in this study because the budget wasn't there to do this, the complex stuff. But we did take some lessons from, again, Brian Kennedy and Simon Melov about the need to look at the same mice over time and time again. And the reason for that is that aging is pretty noisy, anything you measure. Just imagine gathering 50 of your friends of the same age together. There would be some differences, right? You would visibly see differences in aging rate, and you'd visibly see differences in different aging pathologies and things. So this longitudinal design study allows you to track individuals and then track the trajectories of changes in individuals. And that turns out to be a very powerful method. And so what we did was actually to call Susan Howlett in Nova Scotia. And Susan had published a couple of really nice papers suggesting that, you know, if you're a geriatrician and you're sort of looking at general health of someone, there are things that you look at that are not complex. You know, you're not putting people into NMRs, or, you know, you're not doing their genome necessarily. You're doing things like asking them to get out of a chair and walk across the room. And this goes back to the work of Linda Fried and others, who have developed frailty indexes. Basically a way to assess, you know, a person for how frail are they compared to their age and compared to other people of their age. And Susan Howlett, one of many, I should say, has developed a frailty index for mice. And the whole idea is, why don't we make mice more relevant to clinicians? Wouldn't it be great to walk into a geriatrician's office and say, here's the things we measured, and these are the things we think are relevant to human aging as well. So we measured this thing called the frailty index.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the frailty index had like grip strength and coat quality, or so what
yes,
went into
yes.
that?
Coat quality, movement, response to stimuli. This actually looks quite subjective when you look at this thing for the first time, as we did, because you're really just using the power of observation of your right. laboratory PhD students and postdocs to look at an animal. I mean, there's some, as I say, there's response to stimuli, which at least is some sort of intervention, but a lot of it's observational. But I think with the appropriate training, you can see consistency between labs. And then the beauty of this is that we measured, as Susan has, 31 different measures of things that change during aging in the mouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't see them all change because we were starting with sort of later life mice. And so some of those changes may have happened already. But think about collecting 31 different parameters and then collapsing them into a single number, a single score, a single frailty score in this case. And we felt that's where the power comes from in this sort of technique, that, you know, any given thing you're looking at may be misleading, or there may be a large variation upon that thing. But if you start collecting enough of these and collapse them together, then you get a real picture of what's going on. It's I guess I hadn't thought of this before. It's almost like a much scaled down version of doing genomics, where you're taking out a large number of factors, but you're getting an overall picture of what's going on.
Right. So did you see any difference between the sexes when you were doing this?
Yes. So when we looked at lifespan, we did see an effect. And if you pull the sexes together into the analysis, you see that there's actually a 16% difference overall. But if you break out the groups, actually the females are doing better than the males. And that was the case amongst the frailty index measures as well.
Okay.
This is true actually of many interventions in aging in mice. The Mouse Intervention Testing Program is a NIA, National Institutes of Aging funded program. It's been going on for many, many years now. And they see a lot of sex specific differences. And that's really, really important. And it's understudied, to be honest, as to what's going on there.
Do we have any idea what the mechanism for that, why it's different?
No, we don't. Obviously, you're aware of a major concern in National Institutes of Health is that we've been ignoring these sex differences for years. Traditionally, most mouse experiments were done in male mice for somewhat practical reasons, and that's just not acceptable anymore. And now policy is that we look at both sexes. And so in our case, we don't know. Certainly, every measure we made, we were comparing the sex differences. And that's just going to be something that everyone's going to be doing going forward, and especially important in aging, considering not only differences in life expectancy between males and females, but also this incredible reproductive senescence, if you like, or reproductive limits in women is incredibly important and somewhat of a profound mystery.
Right. Yes. Okay. That is interesting. So you did say that AKG levels decrease with age,
yes,
significantly. Do we know why that is?
I'm not aware as to why that is. And of course, we see massive changes in the metabolic profiles between young and old animals. Whether it's to do with changes in energy, I mean, we know that there's vast changes in mitochondrial activity, the home of the TCE cycle. We know that energy demands and energy generation changes a lot. I really don't know at this point, and I'm sure there's some of your viewers out there have much better ideas than I do as to why that's happening.
Okay. Did you measure the AKG levels of your mice? I mean, is this something that you can do outside of a lab?
We did, yes. Outside of a lab, I'm unaware as to whether there's any commercial way to do this for humans right now. I don't think it's part of a standard clinical, profile. Maybe it will be in the future. We've also worked on vitamin D and somewhat of a similar story where vitamin D, when we administer vitamin D to worms, to nematodes, it extends lifespan and it interacts with various aging pathways. And that was really interesting because of the whole literature on vitamin D and chronic disease. I mean, it seems like in humans, if you're deficient in vitamin D, then you're at risk for cancers, not just cancer, but neurological disease, diabetes. It kind of looks like an aging profile. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about vitamin D is that we have that vast literature of, you know, deficiency in humans, some literature on what happens when you megadose on vitamin D. And so it was nice to interact with that human literature with a worm story that suggested it was really slowing aging. So we're not there with AKG yet. We don't have that kind of connection quite yet. And I definitely talked to Brian Kennedy on this, and Brian is going forward to conduct clinical trials at National University of Singapore on AKG administration. So I think that would be, I can't wait to see what's going on.
I hope that you found the video informative. please do hit the thumbs up button and subscribe to our channel, and hit the bell button and choose all for any new video release notifications. It encourages us to continue to create more videos about anti-aging and extending healthy lifespan. Thank you so much for your kind support. I wish you all well, and we'll speak to you again soon.